You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 73. This minute opens with David noticing the holograms and ends with the orrery coming to life. There is a cut between when David is smiling to himself and when he turns to see the holograms. I can't imagine why this was necessary. It's probably barely perceptible to most people, but I think it breaks up the flow. We begin to hear the life theme, but in a minor key. I know I've gushed about this theme enough, but boy, is it powerful in the moment to come. It really does make an impact. We see four engineer males evidently preparing the ship for flight. The nearest engineer uses a flute to activate what appears to be the navigation console. I would have expected David to be paying very close attention to what our navigator here is doing on his console, but no, he's just being a fanboy and playing with the unusual green projections. From what I can tell, the green is emitted from projections of technology where blue is used for everything else, but that's just a theory. A second engineer appears to crouch down before the navigator and tells him something before he turns to witness the orrery. The graphics here were by Fuel Effects, an Australian animation and digital effects company, which has now been absorbed into another Australian animation house, Animal Logic. It's impressive to see just how much of these special effects are coming out of Australia. Like, The Matrix, Star Wars, and the Marvel movies are often filmed here, so it's just been a part of the Hollywood film industry for a while. I know a lot of people say Australian films suck, but these days, how do you even define that? We might not have a lot of productions that are entirely Australian-made, but we work on a lot of major blockbusters. And then you've got things like Upgrade and I Am Mother, which are Australian productions, but you wouldn't notice if you didn't look it up. It's not just about the accents the actors are using. Interesting to note, Fuel Effects went into administration the same year Prometheus was released, and their assets were later acquired by Animal Logic not long after. It's amazing to look at the credits for most effects-heavy movies these days and see that a dozen different companies worked on it. There was a time when it would all be done by one company, ILM or Weta, for example. Like, look at Phantom Menace. There's a lot of visual effects shots, and Jar Jar is one of the first CG animated lead characters. Or perhaps is the first one, depending on who you ask. ILM did it all, and Return of the King is a massive movie filled with lots of complicated digital and practical effects shots. It was almost entirely done by Weta. I would have thought it would be the opposite. As the technology got more sophisticated, it would be managed by fewer and fewer people. But maybe it's not just the case that there are more and more visual effects shots in any given movie, but they are more complicated than ever. I'd be curious to know why. Working on Prometheus, we have Fuel Effects, Weta Digital, Hammerhead Productions, Invisible Effects, Territory Studio, Rising Sun Pictures, Lola VFX, Luma Pictures, and Pixel Pirates. And that's only naming the companies that did final visual effects. There were a few more companies for pre-visuals, 3D scanning, and various other tasks. It seems Gentle Giant is the only company for 3D scanning. They also make nice statues, but they also worked on Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and basically everything you care to imagine. At a glance, I would say Prometheus doesn't seem to have as many visual effects shots as Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, but I think it's a case of subtle effects that you don't even think about. Like, Territory Studio did all the graphical interfaces for any devices you see, and a lot of effects just to extend the sets or hide the green screen and so on, just blending the seams, if you will. The imagery displayed by the orrery here is very complex, and it made me wonder if it really represented anything. So I tracked down this interview with Paul Butterworth of Fuel VFX. He says, "For Ridley, it was all about it looking great. The look was the most important thing rather than whether an effect had a scientific basis or adhered to particular rules." That's a good place to start to create good design work. Of course, to make sense of something as complicated as the orrery, we came up with our own rules as to how it should work, which we workshopped with Richard. But Ridley wasn't so fussed about what those rules were, as long as it looked fantastic and the bigger story points were being served. So evidently, there's not any specific meaning intended by Ridley, but there's likely some internal logic the visual effects artists developed just so it makes sense and they could work on it. The orrery is inspired by a painting from 1766 that Ridley liked called A Philosopher Lecturing on the Orrery by Joseph Wright. Butterworth continues, During the process, we received a Ridleygram, we all know what those are by now, that referenced frog spawn and showed multiple spheres within the orrery. As the script outlined some sort of magnification function in the center of the orrery, whereby an engineer could study a star or planet more closely, we developed the idea that there were also smaller secondary spheres orbiting the center. The idea being that these smaller spheres were pre-selected parts of the universe that could be magnified to a certain extent, and are ready to be moved into the center to be viewed even larger. The gimbal rings are a direct reference to the painting, but in our orrery we came up with the idea that the ring would hold DNA data of the galaxies or solar systems that the engineers had mapped. A wide shot of the orrery has 80 to 100 million polygons, which would be hugely expensive and time-consuming to re-render each time if Ridley or Richard had requested even a minor change, say to the location of a planet or another single element. But we knew we needed to be prepared for that, so the deep image tools allowed our artists the ability to reach in and manipulate areas of their choosing in an interactive way, so they could re-render and recomp that particular section only. So, there we have an indication of what David would have seen, hundreds, perhaps thousands of planets, all mapped and possibly terraformed by the engineers. The full mighty scope of their domain. Here's some more interesting quotes from that article. Honestly, the whole thing is a great read and I will link to it. The shot of David holding the Earth had a particular challenge because he was filmed holding a glowing white ball as a means of casting interactive light on him. The lighting worked great, however it was decided a bit later that the Earth should be quite a bit smaller than the ball he was holding. So that shot was quite a bit of tricky facial and hand restoration on David. And I just think, that sounds way more effort than it were. Why did the Earth have to be smaller? Did it need to be changed? You just work with what you have, guys. In the interview, he mentions Ridley showed them a short film called Magnetic Movie, a short film from 2007 demonstrating visual representations of magnetic fields. I'll also pop that into the footnotes. Something that really fascinates me is how Ridley thinks a lot about visuals and movement. It's about the kinetic energy, the kinesiology of movement, and he almost has the mind of a choreographer. I recently reviewed some Covenant Ridleygrams for Yutani Studios, also in the footnotes, and Ridley's notes were full of references to other films specifically for movement reference. For instance, the engineers being bombed by the mutagen, that scene was inspired in part by the movement of the zombies in World War Z. So it's this really abstract way of looking at things. It's not specific details, it's just how something moves, and I don't think a lot of people think in those terms, and that's quite fascinating to me. Magnetic Movie ended up being the inspiration for the green bands of light over the controls that David passes his hand over. And that's one of those things, is that he just loved the motion, the movement of the magnetic fields. He didn't even tell the visual effects guys, I want it for this. He just went, watch this movie, take some inspiration, try and incorporate that. I don't know how, but just, you know, find a place for it. And they did, and I think it worked well. And now I'll be reading from the Paradise script, pages 70 to 75. Interior, Juggernaut, Bridge, Navigation, Hibernation Room, Day. David more or less where we left him, marveling at the ghost engineers as they move around the massive room. Two are sitting in what we now realize are chairs, talking to each other. But as this conversation happened thousands of years ago, we of course don't hear the words. Another engineer is munching on a piece of what looks like bread, as he walks right towards David. Now the engineer stops, crouches slightly. Now the engineer extends a finger, pointing right at David's head. Jesus, does he see him? The engineer's fingers move forward, passes right through David's eye, and pushes a button on a panel behind his head. David turns now, realizes he's getting a tutorial on how to work this thing. He reaches forward, mimicking the hand gestures of the ghost engineer, as lights flicker on, a long dormant system coming back online. It feels like the whole room is coming to life. Emboldened, David waves his hand over the controls again. Suddenly, all six engineers begin to move 10 times faster, and logic would indicate if these things are recordings from the past, David has just found the fast forward button. He pushes it forward. Now the ghosts are just blurs flying around the room. Sometimes there are more, sometimes less, sometimes none. God knows how many years he is zipping through, how many centuries. But David's advanced systems seem to track it all until he eases up on the control, bringing things back to normal speed. And instead of six fairly relaxed engineers, there is only one. And he's clearly panicked, rushing across the room in fear, leaving the main control area and into a corridor. David, of course, follows him. Four massive chambers, oval pods that resemble streamlined coffins, take up almost the entire room. If we're looking from above, they would form a cross. The ghost waves his hand across one of them in frantic motions, not unlike a conductor, and then he sits in the chamber, lies back like a vampire going to sleep, disappearing in the process. And now David is alone again. On David, internalizing what he just saw, and suddenly understanding what it might mean. David crouches down beside the chamber the ghost just disappeared into, a thick window, and when David peers into it, he sees only murky haze. Or is it frost? He kneels, and now with an almost childlike wonder, he presses his ear to the side of the chamber, just listens. What he's hearing we don't know, but from the other room, a burst of static, someone talking, a woman. David rises, heads back. The navigation center, close on David's helmet, we hear the tinny voice shouting from inside. David, come in. David bends over, reattaches his helmet so he can clearly hear Vicar's voice. Where the hell are you, little shit? Do you copy? David calmly keys his comm. Yes, I'm here. Is everything all right? Interior, Magellan, ready room, intercut, day. Find Vickers pulling on a spacesuit, trying to contain her anger and stress. Vickers, intercom. No, those idiots are about to infect my ship. Get your ass back here right now. Interior, juggernaut, bridge, navigation, hibernation, room, whatever you call it, day. David, intercom. Of course, I'm on my way. Oh, and Miss Vickers? A beat, pointed. It's time for the protocols. Vickers reacts. And although we don't quite understand just what the hell that means, she certainly does, as we smash to exterior, interior, planet, central crater, and rover day. Yannick, hold on. Yannick hits the dune, smashes down to the surface as the rover peels back towards the Magellan. Holloway lies in the back, his head in Shaw's lap. We see the dark veins in his face. Something is happening to him, something bad. Shaw is clearly terrified. Shaw, just try to relax. We're going to get you back to the ship and take care of Holloway. It hurts. Jesus Christ, it burns. Christ, Holloway's skin starts to take on a grayish color. He bites back the pain, tears streaming down his cheeks as he looks up at the woman he loves. Softly, Holloway, we never should have come here. On Shaw, her heart breaking, hearing those words coming out of his mouth. But she puts on her game face, reassuring. Just hold on, okay? He nods, but grits his teeth. Small blisters start to appear in his face, just as the rover screeches to a stop. They finally reached exterior Magellan airlock day. Yannick is already running for the lift. Shaw, open the airlock! To Holloway, come on, I've got you. Shaw puts her arm around him, helps him out of the back of the rover towards the airlock. And now he turns to her, the pain pushing away for just this moment. Tragedy in his eyes as he softly says, Ellie, you can't bring me back on the ship. No, no, we can help you. Charles, please. You can't. It's too late. The airlock door starts to open. Holloway screams, goes to his knees. He's transforming. His suit is starting to tear. Jesus, it's like he's growing. Unsure, tears streaming down her cheeks. The man she loves dying in front of her just as the airlock is finally open. But instead of salvation, it's Vickers, in her suit and hard as nails. And she's holding a makeshift flamethrower. Vickers, step away from him. Shaw is in shock. What? No! God damn it, step away. We can still help him. I'll put him in the med pod. Vickers steps forward, raises the business end of her weapon. The flame flickers in the reflection of her helmet, eyes dark, voice rising. He's not getting anywhere near my med pod because he's not coming on the goddamn ship. Now step away! Shaw opens her mouth to protest again, but Holloway takes her hand, stoic despite the pain. I love you. And before Shaw can respond, before she can do anything, Holloway pushes her away from him, rises up, moves towards Vickers with outstretched arms. Shaw, no! Holloway stops right before her. Rip, his suit shredding, skin bubbling, he softly utters, do it. Vickers doesn't need to be told twice. Tortures Holloway, engulfs his body in flames. He's literally incinerated in front of our eyes before his body even hits the ground. Shaw leaps, tackles Vickers, both of them tumbling back into the airlock. A vicious fight. Yannick and the other crew members pry Shaw off, tears rolling down her face. And then a calm, cool voice. David. Dr. Shaw. Everyone turns to see David. Rover behind him, back from his exploration, standing before Holloway's smoldering body. Shaw, confused, incredulous. What? David steps forward, does his best to appear sympathetic. I understand you're upset, but as you ordered quarantine protocols, it's my responsibility to ask, have you and Dr. Holloway had any intimate contact recently? Oh, no. And offshore, terrified, we smash cut too. And then we cut to her being disinfected and all of that, but... Yeah, I'm glad they sort of played around with a few little details here. So instead of Shaw, you know, having this cat fight pouncing on top of Vickers, it's handled a little bit better than that. They just sort of cut away. And then David rocking up there and in the middle of all of that, being like, oh, by the way, did you do the sex recently? Just not now, David. It's a bit awkward. So yeah, it's one of those things where I mentioned this before, but the Paradise script is quite fascinating to read because it adheres pretty closely to the final film, but just moving those tiny little details around can change the tone, can change the pacing. And that's one of the things I love about filmmaking in general, is that it isn't this... until it's made, you know, finally filmed, made into a file that you can download or stream or what have you, it is an ongoing process. It is almost like a living thing that is constantly adapting and changing. And so that's why I obviously read these scripts and why I love doing a podcast like this, is watching that evolution. And I mean, I've never finished writing anything in my goddamn life, but as someone who enjoys writing as a hobby, it's kind of encouraging. You go, yeah, don't expect your first draft to be anything worthwhile. And I really do. I love the way Damon Lindelof writes. It's excitable, it's energetic. I do find that, like, even the way I deliver it, it's faster paced, it's more intense. It's a lot of fun. The other thing I read this for is just that implication that Holloway is actually growing and changing and turning into something else, which we don't get in the final film, of course. And I think that's a real shame. And then with the orrery scene, yeah, it was obviously originally intended that David would learn by watching the engineers, but in the end, it was just, no, he got this figured out. He doesn't need instructions. And then Vickers saying things like, oh, you little shit. I don't see her talking like that. So they've changed the character a bit as well. And I'm wondering if the engineer kneeling down and pointing at David was a bit of a creation of Adam kind of scenario. Well, that just about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by a Minute on Facebook. And I keep forgetting to mention I have a Ko-fi account. There is a link on my website. Any donation really helps to keep the show hosted and the website going. I'd like to thank Mark Boder again for his donations. Really appreciate it. And looks like I'm getting another episode out a week after the last one, so we're getting on track. We might be able to get through Prometheus this year, guys. Maybe. September? Yeah, still got time. All right. See you next week.